fact is, like, there's a good chance based on tomorrow that, yeah, the unemployment rate is above the Fed's year-end forecast, and that's at the same time that they're starting to worry a lot more about the labor market. So I would be looking towards that to really know whether this rotation that we're seeing right now has legs. Essentially, I would even say that there's three types of cuts. So there's maintenance cuts, which I would characterize as basically keeping in line with current policy, because on a real basis, because inflation is coming down, and as inflation comes down, real rates increase. So to remain at the same level of restrictiveness, or even just slightly less restrictive, they would have to cut a federal funds rate just to stay at a somewhat similar level. And then you have something like a panic cut, which often is related to geopolitical events. And then the last one is the one that everybody knows about, and that's like these recessionary, long-winded cut cycles. These are the ones that we saw in 2020, 2008, and these are the ones that people really look at when they pull up a chart and look at, you know, sustained cuts all the way to the zero lower bound at the same time that the market is still crashing. And that's because the Fed is late to the game and they're trying to catch back up and get a hold on markets.
Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Joe Consorti. Today we're here with Felix Javan, macro analyst and host of the On the Margin podcast at Blockworks Macro. Felix, thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks. Great to be here. You know, I've been a fan of you guys' show and, you know, really, really excited to be on a fellow crypto or Bitcoin macro type of show. So it's going to be really great.
Absolutely. There are very few of us, so, you know, may as well hit the tape and collaborate a little bit. And also, you know, your Twitter account has been great when it comes to getting the macro noise out of there and just having pure macro signal. Here's what you should focus on. And we value that a lot here at TBL, and I know our viewers do too. So you're the perfect guest. So let's jump right into it here. We had some economic data this morning, and we'll go and talk about the rates reaction function to it, where we are in the cycle, the FOMC presser. But first things first, let's lay the groundwork here with kind of what happened this morning. What were the big prints that kind of caught your eye, and what's the story behind them? We had claims that came in. We had ISM data that came in. So, you know, to your eye, what are the substantial developments here that happened this morning?
Yeah, so we had the ISMs, which we can start with, and these have been really confusing throughout this cycle. They've been catching a lot of people off guard. You know, we hit some you know, cycle lows a couple of years ago that had a lot of people thinking we're on the verge of a recession, and then we kind of went in the opposite direction, and it feels like we're sort of in that moment again where, yeah, like we had the manufacturing PMI came in at 46.8, and it was forecasted to be 48.8. So that's a pretty big miss to the downside. That's really starting to get people to think that this, you know, this economic slowdown might actually be accelerating slower. And we're really seeing that in how markets are reacting to that. You know, pretty much the entire yield curve is rallying pretty significantly today. TLT has been up pretty strongly today so far. But at the same time, equities are actually going lower. So that's a dynamic that we haven't seen that regularly in the last couple of years, where typically it's been as the long end rallies, that provides a bit of a buffer to equities, and the equities rally as well. But we're seeing that opposite. So it really feels like this classic flight to safety rotation. That's coming at the same time that, again, like you said, we got this jobless claims number that was 249,000 and is forecasted at 236. So a lot of these you know, economic prints are coming in and they're signifying that we're in a proper slowdown. You know, I have been looking at the slowdown for the past couple months. I thought that perhaps we were getting to this trough as, you know, this financial conditions loop that we've been seeing over the last couple of years, that as, you know, the market gets really excited and starts to price in a bunch of cuts, everybody gets excited again. And because of how hyper-financialized, you know, society is these days, that just leads to reacceleration of the economy. It feels like this might be the one where it actually continues to slow. So that's creating this interesting dynamic where the Fed is not rushing. Obviously, we had the Fed FOMC meeting yesterday and they did not cut. They pretty much signaled and baked in the September cut, but that's, you know, that's quite a time away. We have no FOMC meeting in August, so we got to wait all the way till September for any sort of reaction outside of, you know, aside from some sort of emergency thing, but I highly doubt that. So now the market is looking at these economic data prints come in and they're saying, okay, hold on, it seems like something's really changed here. At the same time that it feels like the Fed is just, you know, pressed pause for 2 months to see what's going to happen until September. So I feel like that's sort of that panic that we're seeing in the market today.
The Bitcoin Layer is proud to be sponsored by Unchained, the leader in Bitcoin financial services. Unchained empowers you to take full control of your Bitcoin with a collaborative multi-sig vault, where you hold two of the three keys and benefit from a Bitcoin security partner. Purchase Bitcoin directly into your cold storage vault and eliminate exchange risks with Unchained's trading desk. Unchained also offers the best IRA product in the industry, allowing you to easily roll over your old 401ks or IRAs into Bitcoin while keeping control of your keys. Don't pay more taxes than you have to. Talk to them today. Visit unchained.com/TBL and use code TBL for $100 off when you create an account. And now back to the video. Gotcha. Wonderful. And I'll share another chart because what you referenced is like this cycle, we've had like a lot of false starts almost, like ISM in particular, you know, it jumped below that 50 mark and we've kind of just been trending around here. And I'll actually zoom in. You've seen in prior cycles, it's more definitive. Like when a recession is declared, we really dive underneath it. But over the last, you know, 2.5 years or 2 years, we've kind of just been, you know, will they, won't they right here. And so what are you seeing that makes you say, okay, now this time is the one? And I suppose it's also factoring into Powell's thinking, because why else would he be saying, okay, we now see sufficient restrictiveness has been achieved. So I suppose it's like a two-pronged question, because you probably know what Powell's looking at, but what are you looking at that tells you like, okay, this time is the one, whereas all these false, you know, what's different now compared to all these false starts that we've had?
Yeah, so the first one, it's the one that I'm looking at and that Powell is definitely looking at, is the labor market. You know, looking at back at like 2022 when we were all starting to talk about recessions, the labor market was the tightest it's pretty much ever been. It was pretty insane. Like you're not really going to be getting any sort of recession when the labor market is that tight. We're in a really different story now, and we're seeing that being reflected in how the Fed is talking. They've, you know, re-included dual mandate in their FOMC statement, as opposed to just talk about inflation risk. So they can see that balance is coming in. And this is a great chart just showing, because it's a great leading indicator of where unemployment rates are going, is looking at jobless claims. So again, when you combine what we're seeing of, you know, higher than expected initial jobless claims, and we're starting to see the unemployment rate actually head higher, like 2 years ago, you know, when we got these false starts, that was not the case. That is definitely the case today. So we're having that occur. Basically, the labor market is for sure loosening. It's still secularly somewhat tight. You know, when we're having a 4.1% unemployment rate, that's still pretty, you know, pretty low. But the trend is what matters. So That's something that's very different, and that's something that's significant. A lot of that there's some noise around that data because of what's been going on with immigration dynamics. So that's difficult to be certain about whether that unemployment rate of 4.1 and trending higher is high quality of an indicator or not. But the fact is, it's going up. So that's the first one. The second one is around inflation, and something that Powell talked a few times about yesterday was the employment cost index. That's their key look into wage price growth. That's the key indicator that they look at. Yesterday that came in soft. So that's telling them we're not seeing this wage price spiral, which is pretty much the biggest thing that they're scared of, because that could just really let inflation get crazy. So that's coming in lower. And something that he also talked about was how now the disinflation that we're getting is a lot more of high quality. A couple years ago, over the last year and a half or so, the disinflation we've been getting has been mostly in goods. Now we're seeing it in services and a lot more of these lagging indicators. And to him, that's a lot more high quality. So when I look at the labor market, when I look at the quality of the disinflation, those are very different from 2 years ago. And we're seeing a triangulation of a lot more data points that are saying this is an actual slowdown. Now the big question is it a slowdown or does it turn into a recession? And, you know, we can get more into that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your point, I have the breakdown of the components of the inflation bucket. And you can see here, yeah, you're right on the money. I mean, we had goods, food, energy, that made up the bulk of disinflation when we went from like 9.1% all the way down to when we hit 3% initially. But since then, all the disinflation we've been experiencing has been, you know, more high quality, as you've said, in services, which tend to be a little bit stickier. And so it seems like that is the welcome development that Powell needs to see in order to say, okay, great, it's time to ease off the brakes, or it's time to ease off the gas, rather. Mm-hmm.
Totally.
Wonderful. Yeah. So let's talk about rates before we dive into the FOMC statement. Wild action in rates. Basically, the entire curve is hugely down. Twos and tens in particular. Twos are down 25 basis points. Tens are down 26 basis points. And really, this comes after, like, you know, a year, 2 years of just straight up choppiness in this, like, 3.5 to all the way up to 5% level. Like, this seems like the first time that tens are really taking a nosedive and saying, okay, growth and inflation expectations are weakening massively. Twos are repricing now that the Fed has explicitly called for a cut come September. So, you know, in your mind, what are your thoughts on what rates are doing? And then also the implications of that for, like, risk assets. Like, is this a massive risk off move that's going to draw liquidity from risk markets, or, you know, no? And if not, why not? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this move has surprised me. I was pretty constructive on yields coming down, so bond prices going up into the most recent CPI print that we had. And that got us to, I don't remember the specific print, but on the 10-year, you know, it was, I don't know, maybe 4.15 and change or something like that. And that felt somewhat right for this slowdown that we're getting into. But what we see now, especially over the last couple of days, is, yeah, the 10-year broke the four handle and is at, yeah, like 3.96 right now. And that's like, when you compare that to what we're seeing in, say, like, nominal GDP, that's printing above 5%. Like, those two things are normally pretty tightly correlated. And the fact that we're seeing this huge breakdown while these GDP prints are printing where they are, you know, a 10-year yield price is going to be a bit more forward-looking, obviously, than GDP. But the fact is, there's this big contrast happening right now between what markets perceive and what we're seeing in some of these more lagging prints, such as GDP. So what's that telling us? It's telling us that the market thinks, and especially when you look at what's priced into the curve on the shorter end in terms of, like, Fed rate cuts, they're not pricing in a normalization cut as much right now. It's starting to get into the realm of potentially recessionary cuts. You know, if I think about, you know, we can circle back on the long end in a sec, but when I think about normalization cuts, that's 1 to 3 cuts over, I don't know, 12 months or something like that, just following real rates as inflation is coming down, basically. What we're seeing right now is something that I would say is somewhat different. We're seeing, you know, 3 rate cuts by the end of this year, and then a continuation of that into the following year. So that, compared with what's going on in the long end, where, you know, a 10-year sub 4% and this huge rally at the same time that equities are coming lower, this is a pretty classic growth scare rotation that we're seeing right now. So I think that's, you know, the market might be getting ahead of where the current economic data is, because it's not that scary right now, but it seems to be that it's thinking we're heading in that direction.
Of course. And when we talk about, you know, the difference between maintenance cuts and, you know, normalization cuts, like, this is the inversion of twos to Fed funds. Like, it's extremely deep, extremely deep. Like, if you take a look at this chart of twos, I mean, Fed funds right now, what's the upper bound at? Like 5.5, 5.50? Yeah. So for twos to be trading at 4.18, that tells you that, okay, maybe the market is pricing in 3 cuts by year end, bringing us down to, you know, 4.50. Certainly twos are telling a different story. They're saying that, yeah, it looks like we're going to be more aggressive than this. So do you think that that's what the rates market is starting to price in, like, actual real recessionary risks and then rate cuts that are going to come behind that?
It's getting close to that point for sure. Like, I think if we had this discussion 2 days ago, I'd probably say no. But when I look at the move right now, it's like, okay, we're starting to get extended. So, you know, maybe this is the bottom and we just, the bottom in yields, and we just reverse higher and rebound, and that's it for the growth scare. But it's getting to that point. And this really brings up this framework that I've had for a while, pretty much since, like, the June FOMC meeting, where I was taken aback by the summary of economic projections, where they only guided towards, like, 1 cut this year. And a lot of people thought, you know, they were at 3 on the previous dot plot. Most of the market thought they'd go down to 2. They went to 1. That was somewhat surprising. And it started to get in my head this framework of wondering, okay, if they're going to be too scared to cut because they got burned in the first couple quarters of the year where inflation picked up again in front of them, that could lead to them waiting too long to cut and, you know, potentially causing this minor slowdown to accelerate into recession. And this is a lot of what you're starting to see with these op-eds that are coming out recently, like Bill Dudley, who is the former head of the New York Fed, wrote an op-ed last week. And he was talking about how it's really time to cut rates. Like, they should be cutting at this meeting that we had yesterday. Obviously, they didn't. But that's where the mindset is at. So now we have to start figuring out, as investors and traders, is, you know, a slowdown is great. especially because we've been in this inflationary world, and that's obviously going to bring inflation down somewhat. But we don't want to go too far to start thinking about, okay, this might actually turn recessionary. And that's the dynamic that we're also, that you're also talking about whether normalization cuts can be bullish for markets, but, you know, 5 to 6 cuts, that's telling a different story about what's going on.
Yeah. And so it seems like the story changed so much in like a week, even 2 days. By 2 days ago, knowing that Powell was going to cut rates, normalization cuts, great. Yesterday, okay, fantastic. He's managing this cycle perfectly. That's wonderful. But then today, seeing the move that rates have made, today alone, but in the last 5 days, it's now like, okay, it seems like the market is really, really getting scared about growth. Maybe Powell should have, he's been good at recognizing the balance of risks so far between reacceleration and, you know, extreme deceleration. And it seemed up until yesterday that he had played it perfectly. But now with the move in rates we're seeing, it begs the question, maybe he should have done this a month ago, 2 months ago.
Yeah, that's definitely what the market feels. I mean, this is the thing with the market, though, is that like the market moves on a dime on a single data point, and like that can get tricky too. Like we need to look at the aggregate of the data. That's like something Powell talks about all the time. He's like, we're not looking at one single data point. And I think that's valid. So yes, the market reacts quickly to, okay, this morning ISM down lower than forecasted.
Exactly, but for all we know, tomorrow's payrolls report may be excellent. And then
exactly.
Most of the move gets
worse. And I was going to say, like, we have the jobs report tomorrow, and that's the big one I'm looking at. Like, if we're already at the unemployment rate year-end forecast for the Fed, 4.1%, and it's August. So tomorrow, if we get 4.2 even percent on the unemployment rate, we are above the Fed's year-end forecast at the same time that the Fed and Powell has said that they don't want to see really any more loosening in the labor market. So that starts to set off some red flags for me. Now, again, like we talked about, there could be some noise in that data because of the labor supply has been increasing from a ton of immigration. So it's hard to be totally specific. But the fact is, like, there's a good chance based on tomorrow that the unemployment rate is above the Fed's year-end forecast, and that's at the same time that they're starting to worry a lot more about the labor market. So I would be looking towards that to really know whether this rotation that we're seeing right now has legs.
Excellent. And so shifting gears here, I suppose. I almost said pivoting, which is funny. let's talk about the FOMC statement. So I actually have the strike-through comparison in front of me. I know you were on top of it yesterday. I'm only retroactively looking at it because I was interviewing Cynthia Lummis yesterday and I was so busy with that. Nice. And so I'm only now getting to look at the statement. I obviously read it before we hopped on the call. I'm a Fed watcher myself. I know you're a Fed watcher. We have to be. I just tweeted a chart out. The mentions of the Federal Reserve during S&P 500 earnings calls is at an all-time high. And so now, like, the Fed is totally in control. And this goes back to your point about the financialization, the over-financialization of markets. But I digress. Let's talk about this statement. A lot of changes in here. A lot of changes in here. Going, 30,000 feet, what are the big changes that you notice? And are they more dovish or more hawkish?
Yeah. So I went through that statement yesterday and tweeted it and right away mentioned that it was dovish. But I had to clarify, and it's super important to clarify, that there's dovish versus like absolute changes and dovish versus expectations. So the changes in this statement, if you look at each of them on their own and in total isolation from any sort of expectation, they're clearly dovish. We're going from, the biggest one for me was looking at, they're saying the community is attentive to the inflation risk. They changed that to both sides of the dual mandate. So they're saying we need to weigh the labor market a lot more and not just inflation like we have been historically. Exactly.
Which is something that you've been saying for months now and something that we've been saying at TBL too.
Yeah, exactly. And so now we're starting to see it show here. Same with, looking at, employment and inflation goals continue to move into better balance. That's somewhat neutral. But overall, what you're showing here is a slight tweak in language that's saying we're much more focused on the dual mandate. We're much more focused on, growth risks as opposed to a rebound in inflation sort of risk. So the thing is, those all in isolation are obviously dovish changes. Like, I don't think anybody would argue with that. The fact is that that might be different from whether it's dovish versus expectations of the market. So the market is, going into that meeting, we'd already been at 100% priced in for a September cut. So the market was already looking that, you know, potentially they would add something in that statement saying we plan to cut at the next meeting or something like that. They didn't do that, so some people perceived it as being hawkish. And then obviously we had the press conference after, and that's where Powell really, you know, took the unveiled what to, you know, the true guidance was moving forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. So looking at the statement, you know, he changed remain strong to moderated. Mm-hmm. He explicitly talked about attentive to both sides of the dual mandate. So now he's recognizing, you know, what we've said for a while. He's recognizing that the balance of risks is more 50-50, if not 55-45, toward the labor market being the primary focus and inflation kind of being on the back burner now that we're getting more high quality disinflation. So you said the presser is really, you know, kind of where he unveiled it. He talked about it. I know he explicitly said September, and you tweeted out, he said September, it's a lock. And so talk to us about the big moments in the press conference.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, like for people that aren't, you know, crazy nerdy Fed watchers, you got to really understand Fed talk. So what happened was that as soon as, you know, basically Powell showed up, he had his written statement, and then the first question came in. And the first question was basically, you know, to put it simply, is are you going to cut in September? And right away he flipped through his books and he had prepared remarks to talk specifically to that and guide the market. And basically what he said was that as long as nothing crazy happens between now and September, they're going to cut. Now, what he actually said was, you know, if the data stays consistent with, you know, what's been happening, we may be able to cut as soon as next meeting. And that sounds like a maybe, but really when you look into Fed talk and how Powell and these chairs speak, that's as certain as you're ever going to get from a you know, head of a central bank.
Yeah, so they're the kings of saying a lot without saying anything, like hedged language. Yeah, basically like dual-sided language. And so for him to actually explicitly say, mm-hmm, we may be able to cut by next meeting is a huge development.
Yeah, I was shocked that he even said the word September. I sort of was going into it thinking that, okay, well, you know, it's July, the next meeting is in September. They have the Jackson Hole Symposium at the end of August, which is often, you know, not necessarily a place where they explicitly guide towards policy decisions, but it is a place where if they're planning major pivots in monetary policy, oftentimes they do unveil it there. So I thought, okay, what would be the incentive to really guide towards September in the July meeting when he has that at the end of August, and that would allow some time for some more good data to come in? But he didn't. He said September, and that's where I tweeted, and I was just like, it's a lock. Like this is locked in. And you know, the market took that and ran with it. We pretty quickly saw, you know, yields across the board come down. We're now at like 3 rate cuts priced in for the rest of this year. So yeah, you know, it was dovish, that's for sure.
Yeah, dovish most definitely. And we know that these cuts, at least ceteris paribus, should these growth concerns that are reflected in rates not actually materialize, we know these cuts are maintenance cuts. And so they're cuts that are coming in advance of or anticipation of further slowdown to kind of limit the downside, almost serve as a cushion. Before we get into kind of previous regimes where we've done maintenance cuts, we have one really good analog when Powell was Fed chair, when he was very early on in his years. Explain to the viewers who may not know the difference between maintenance cuts and just rate cuts that occur because the Fed's trying to, you know, save an economy that's getting destroyed.
Yeah, totally. So this is something that trips out a lot of people because, you know, when you just pull up a chart of, say, you know, the SPX and Fed funds rate, it looks on the surface, on a quick look, that every time they start cutting, the market crashes. But it takes either living through those moments to really understand or going back and back testing the data very specifically. And essentially, I would even say that there's three types of cuts. So there's maintenance cuts, which I would characterize as basically keeping in line with current policy because on a real basis, because inflation is coming down, and as inflation comes down, real rates increase. So to remain at the same level of restrictiveness or even just slightly less restrictive, they would have to cut federal funds rate just to stay at a somewhat similar level. That's a normalization cut. And then you have something like a panic cut, which often is related to geopolitical events, you know, something like 9/11, where the, you know, some sort of geopolitical or global risk event occurs, And just to make sure that, you know, markets don't get unhinged, they may cut once or something like that. And then the last one is the one that everybody knows about, and that's like these recessionary, long-winded cut cycles. These are the ones that we saw in 2020, 2008, and these are the ones that people really look at when they pull up a chart and look at, you know, sustained cuts all the way to the zero lower bound at the same time that the market is still crashing. And that's because the Fed is late to the game and they're trying to catch back up and get a hold on markets. So those are really the main three.
Perfect. Yeah, and we've I mean, at least people who've been involved in markets for the last 5 years have seen two of those types of cuts. We've seen a panic cut, which happened as a result of COVID. And before that, we were in a regime of maintenance cuts where risk actually did really well. And I think it'd be helpful to viewers. I actually prepared this chart. I showed you it beforehand to kind of see these three types of cuts. I could even zoom a little bit further out. And so what Felix was talking about here is where the Fed is doing maintenance cuts, right? Basically, the same regime we're in now. The Fed has determined that after an on-hold period, they've reached sufficient restrictiveness, so they begin incrementally cutting by the smallest increments. And then a panic cut, which you see here, the Fed cut from, I think we were at 175 on the upper bound to 25 basis points on the upper bound, all the way down to zero. And that was in during COVID. And then you kind of see what you were just mentioning, which is a more sustained regime of cutting, you know, as there's this massive, you know, sequence of recessionary cuts all the way down. So maybe you can explain how the S&P 500 or how risk assets using the S&P 500 kind of as our proxy reacts during these three types of cuts. Sorry for the messy annotations, but.
That's okay. So just honing in on 2019 for a second. At that time is very similar to where we're at right now. You know, even Powell mentioned 2019 multiple times yesterday during the press conference. He talked about how labor markets were similar to 2019. It's an analog I've been really focused on because I think it's the most similar. So what was going on back then? September 2019, we were still sort of in an era of quantitative tightening. But then the repo market blew out. And overnight, the Fed basically had to end quantitative tightening and basically open up standing repo loans. We're sort of in a similar world to that right now, but instead, what's happening is they've already tapered QT, and we also already have the standing repo facility available. So that can't really happen as like it did in 2019. And that's because they're focused on what happened in 2019 and they're worried about that happening again. So that dynamic is happening right now in terms of just the balance sheets and mechanics. Labor market and economic growth, similar to 2019, where it was, you know, the labor market was loosening a little bit, but I wouldn't call it, you know, falling apart. Growth was still good. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't negative by any means. So what happened is that the Fed decided to cut rates, and the way Powell sold it is as a mid-cycle adjustment. That was the language back then. So he was saying we're gonna have a mid-cycle adjustment, a cut, maybe two, and then we're gonna hang out and see how the market digests that. And the market digested that from the S&P 500 just rallying like crazy and hitting new all-time highs. So this was all happening around like fall 2019. At that time, there was no talk about COVID. COVID didn't technically even exist yet. So that was going on. And then what gets muddied by this in this chart, unless you were like living through that or really digging deep, is that then COVID happened. And then February, you know, to March, the markets completely fell apart, and they, like you said, they had to panic cut from 175 down to zero, basically. So that muddies what was occurring beforehand during
A
those
totally
maintenance
different
cuts.
story if you just stop the chart right here, right?
Exactly,
That
yeah.
there's two completely different stories. And you're right, people confuse these all the time. They go, well, Powell is a terrible Fed speaker. But you got to realize he is one of, if not the only Fed speaker who is able to manage telling the market, hey, we're going to cut rates without setting them into a tizzy and causing spoos to go the opposite direction.
Yeah, totally. So again, you gotta either live and trade through these or really dig in deep. You can't just pull up a chart and quickly look at it because it just doesn't tell the whole story. And so, you know, this happened again, and you know, in the mid 1990s, there was also some normalization cuts, and the economy looked quite similar. So it feels like we're in the middle of an economic cycle, and it's around these times where, yeah, we might see these normalization cuts, we might see a little growth scare, but then we continue higher. So that's still my base case, but you know, we got to be really careful to make sure that that actually occurs and we don't just start falling lower and turn into a potential recession.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the Fed has done a great job at observing all of the risks and observing them well in advance. And so I continue to think that Powell will manage this cycle effectively and be data dependent. I mean, he's been tremendous at being data dependent thus far. And so I do know that, like, if these current risks, these scares actually materialize into something bigger, Powell will have a plan for that to make sure that we avert recession. We saw how quickly they established BTFP in March, right? Literally, overnight, brand new facility, come get the facility. And all of a sudden, what was supposed to be like, okay, this is the end of the cycle, we rebounded higher, banks were reliquified, everything was fine. So I have a feeling we'll see something like that again if we see any actual downside risk
Yeah, I
coming
do
up.
too. I think like the ultimate losing trade is thinking that the Fed is cornered. Like they will always be able to spin something up like that, like BTFP. Like, we always hear that, oh, they're out of ammunition. And right now they have the most ammunition they've had in a very long time. Like Fed funds is very elevated. They have all these different monetary plumbing facilities established now that have basically played whack-a-mole over the last few years to ensure that any sort of monetary plumbing issue will not arise. The Treasury is playing their part. They have Treasury buybacks, ramping up now. That's heading higher. So there's a lot of these facilities in play to basically, like, we on the show on the margin, we often call it like vol control, vol controllers. There's all these vol control facilities going on. So it's a losing trade to fade that, I think.
Yeah, don't fade the Fed, especially with Jerome Powell at the head of it. In that vein, let's shift gears here. We'll talk Treasury refunding announcement that was earlier this week. So buybacks, they came in much higher than anticipated. So what are the implications of those buybacks? If you actually want to explain the mechanism of that for our
Yeah,
audience.
so buybacks is something that was done, I forget, maybe like 40 years ago or something like that by the Treasury, and it's being brought back in now. And basically, the mechanics behind it is when the Treasury market seizes up, what actually seizes up is the long end and specifically off-the-run bonds. So off-the-run bonds are basically the bonds that are not the most recently issued bonds of that tenor. So they're more illiquid. They don't trade as frequently. The spreads are wider. They're hard to get out of. A lot of the time, the traders or hedge funds just going through like a carry trade or something like that to trade that basically at liquidity. So what happens is that when the Treasury market seizes up, nobody wants to buy or sell. Everyone wants to sell, but nobody wants to buy those off-the-run long-end bonds. And that's what the thing that seizes up, and that's often the thing that causes the Fed to truly panic pivot and start doing QE and all those sort of things. So what we're seeing now is that they spent a lot of 2023 talking about implementing this Treasury buyback facility, and now we're seeing it actually rolling out. It's still very small numbers, relatively speaking. It started, I believe, at 15 billion, and like you said, they've increased it to 30 billion. I do think some people somewhat expected that. So I wouldn't say it was totally unexpected, but it is increasing. So what happens is that they will issue most likely bills, something on the short end that's super liquid and, on the run, obviously, because it's the most recently issued. And then the proceeds from that, they'll go and buy the long end off-the-run bonds and basically just do a little. It's almost like a twist. Operation Twist is something that the Fed did years ago. This is sort of like a version of that, of just managing the curve. So we had an update to that came out this week where, yeah, they've increased that amount. And, I think they're still sort of testing how that mechanics operate mechanically in the market on a day-to-day basis. So, 30 billion, it's still, when we're talking treasury market numbers, that's not that big. But it is. It's heading higher, and the fact is that I think if a crisis ever occurred, they could flip the switch and turn that to 100 billion overnight if they needed to. There's a ton of demand for bills that could be soaked up. So that was one significant development that we saw as well.
Absolutely. And what are the implications of all this bill issuance? Because people have been talking about it. People have been talking about how all this bill issuance is driving people. It's positive for risk. It's positively convex with risk. So like, are because the buybacks are helping the Fed in a way, because they're helping to manage the curve. They're staving off or lowering the likelihood of any kind of liquidity event in the Treasury market by what they're doing. With all this bill issuance and Powell trying to tighten financial conditions, are they at odds? Have they been at odds? Like the Fed and the Treasury?
I think maybe on the surface level at odds, but I mean when you dig down a little bit deeper, I feel like they're somewhat aligned as well. Like Powell and Janet Yellen's a previous Fed chair. Powell and Yellen are pretty close. They meet every week for lunch. That came out in like a recent Congress testimony. Like they are working hand in hand together. And, you know, if you just look at like the QT taper that happened a couple months ago. The mechanics of what that does is that it leads to a lower need of treasury issuance and especially bill issuance. So that is helping the treasury, and the treasury is helping the Fed because they're, you know, not issuing as much on the long end, which means that as QT occurs, it's really focused on the short end and also just the exhaust valve that is the reverse repo facility. So they work pretty closely together. But focusing on that bill issuance side of things, yeah, it's, you know, there's been some interesting academic research that came out recently, and they call it activist treasury issuance. And it was a really great paper from Nouriel Roubini. And really what it gets into is that by weighting the issuance towards the bill side is basically a version of QE. Whereas QE removes duration from the market by buying long end bonds, ATI or activist treasury issuance just stops that duration from being on the market in the first place. So instead of, you know, taking in the demand, they're just lowering the supply. So it's effectively, they went through the models, it's effectively the same thing. So by shifting that weighting, a percentage of issuance to the bill side, they're removing duration from the market. That allows markets and risk markets overall to take on more risk because the duration that needs to be taken up by the market is just not as high as it would be if they were weighing coupons more so. So as that occurs, at the same time, like, when you look at bills, that's really, really close to being money versus something like a 10, 20, 30 year bond. That's much less money. That's a lot more like a risk asset. So at the same time that everything I just talked about, when you just issue more bills, in a way that's money printing. Like, bills are so close to being just like US dollars. They're very much money like in our modern system. So as you weight that, you're marginally weighting and increasing the amount of dollars in the system. So when you look at what's been going on the last 2 years, suddenly a lot of these things make sense, that inflation has been stickier than the Fed expected, markets are soaring, and the economy is doing pretty well.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's one thing you said that he said, all you really need to know from the QRA stuff. And it was this sentence: the Treasury does not anticipate needing to increase nominal coupon or FRN auction sizes for at least the next several quarters. Why is this the most important thing from the refunding announcement?
Yeah, so basically we're in this funny world now where the Treasury has adopted forward guidance, and that's what it is now. Like, we didn't have this before in the QRAs, but now we do, which is really funny. So what are they saying? They're saying that we've already forecasted the amount of coupons or bonds or that long end duration debt that we're talking about that we need. And we don't plan to increase that for at least the next several quarters. So let's call it a year. Now that we know that any sort of change in the amount of issuance that's required from the Treasury is going to be taken up by T-bill issuance. And again, like we talked about, T-bill issuance is basically a version of money printing, and it's also ATI, activist treasury issuance, it's a form of QE. So basically what that's saying to us is that Yellen and the Treasury have just guided to us that we're going to be leaning towards bill issuance. And again, that goes through the mechanics of everything we talked about. So that's really the main point. The reason people care about the QRA these days is because we issue so much debt now that it really matters and shifts the needle about where the maturity is that we issue that debt on. So by knowing that it's not going to be on the long end, we know it's going to be on the front end. That's bullish for risk.
Phenomenal. And the US Treasury taking up, you know, a form of forward guidance doesn't surprise me at all, given how well it's worked for the Fed. I mean, they've been extremely data dependent, and they also guide the market. They want the market to know what's coming next. And that's the most important thing. The market hates uncertainty. It prices things, when times are uncertain, the market simply doesn't like it. And so it does it in a very volatile, what would otherwise be volatile era, given what happened in 2020 and what's happened since, like, you know, with over financialization now, obviously since 2008, the increased role of the Treasury and the Fed that they're playing, it does make a lot of sense that now the Treasury is implementing forward guidance too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And I mean, I saw a tweet the other day from the same authors that wrote that ATI paper, looking at like who was on the actual like TBAC, like the Treasury Barring Advisory Committee, and a lot of these people are ex-Fed officials, which is funny. And there's been a flow of Fed officials towards the Treasury. So yeah, I totally agree. It's not a surprise.
Phenomenal. Well, you know, so much for separate institutions, right? Excellent. Well, Felix, we covered a whole lot, man. There's so much value in this episode for people who want to know how to monitor a cycle effectively, know what the Fed is doing. We're Fed watchers here ourselves at the Bitcoin layer, so we really appreciate you coming on and providing your insight there as well. Do you have any closing thoughts on what's important to look out for from the Fed for the rest of the year, or you know, views on how the rest of this cycle plays out for the end of the year and beyond?
First thing, totally appreciate coming on, and definitely big fan of you guys, and just supporting anybody that's focusing on the Bitcoin macro intersection, because it's my favorite thing in the world. So it's really great to be here. Again, my framework is trying to figure out whether this is a slowdown that rebounds or is it a potential recession, because that's going to tell me whether to fade the price in cuts right now or not. The market right now is getting very close to pricing in recessionary cuts. That's obviously different from what the Fed is guiding towards. So you got to decide yourself whether you believe the market or where we stand at the Fed, and again, whether you believe that this is a slowdown that rebounds or is it going to accelerate into a recession. So that's what I'm focused on, and that's going to tell me a lot of things about how to allocate for the rest of this year. That's going to tell me whether to be bearish bonds, bullish bonds. That's going to tell me whether to be bullish risk or bearish risk. For the most part, I've been bearish, or sorry, super bullish on equities since, you know, like late December. I had like an end of year SPX target of 6,000, which seemed crazy back then, but we're like, I don't know, I think like 10% away from that. It's really not that far off now. And a lot of that driven is because of the fiscal dominant side of things, that's been going on, and just the deficits we run, and basically just not allowing a recession to occur in a way. So that's somewhat a framework that I still believe in, but we need to see buy-in from the Fed. We need to see whether they commit to that September cut or not, and also just where the economic data comes in. So I'm cautiously bullish for the rest of this year. Again, the way I look at Bitcoin is as just the most in tune signal rate to ratio of liquidity and monetary policy and currency debasement. So as long as we're heading in that direction of dovishness easing biases, either from the Treasury or the Fed, we got to look at both pretty closely nowadays. I'm still bullish Bitcoin as well.
Phenomenal. All eyes on economic data, all eyes on what the Fed's going to do. Everyone watching this video, make sure, well, actually, it'll go live afterward, but we'll see how the non-farm payrolls report did. And we completely agree with you. Bitcoin is the world's best proxy for global markets. It is, you know, whether we're talking global liquidity, monetary policy, all of it. It is the last functioning fire
Totally.
alarm, I think, is the language that Luke
Yeah.
Gromman used. And it's true, right? It's rules without rulers. It's totally unmanipulated. I mean, obviously there are entities who hold paper Bitcoin and manipulate it and other things, but largely unmanipulated. There are no circuit breakers, 24/7, 365 global liquidity. So yeah, you know, that's why it's more important than ever to fold Bitcoin into a global macro framework, because it really can provide signal. If you're monitoring the correlation regimes with Bitcoin and other assets and making sure you're on top of that, you can understand what Bitcoin is telling you, and what it's signaling about what's to come too.
Very well said. Agreed. I think I wish more people looked at it through that lens, but we're getting there.
We are. I mean, you know, strategic Bitcoin reserve
Exactly.
has been talked about by the presidential candidate, and legislation's out for it. So we'll see what happens. A lot of education needed, though, and I know for a fact that you'll be helping out tremendously on the education front. So in that vein, you know, kind of signing off here, where would you like people to send? Where would you like to send people?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm, you know, hosting interviews weekly on the Margin, and then we have our weekly roundup as well. Very similar type of content of macro and Bitcoin, also some crypto as well in there, but pretty surface level on where they both intersect. But yeah, all things Blockworks, and yeah, just really appreciate you having me on and inviting me and letting me to talk. It's nice to be on the other side of the mic for once.
Right. It certainly is. So yeah, everybody go follow him on Twitter as well. You know, check him out on the margin. You could just search up Blockworks Macro on YouTube. You could find it or find him on X at Fejau_Inc. That's FEJAU_INC. Felix, really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, Joe, appreciate that.